Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. This week we're taking a foray into the world of wind band music, but before we do that, let's guess that lick. Guess that lick or don't miss the
prize. Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-host will have three listens to Guess That Lick. For a maximum of 5 points per episode, here's the scoring breakdown. 1 point each for the piece, the movement, the composer, the time period, and the genre.
Right, and this week I'm bringing a lick for Fernando to guess, and one of these will actually be kind of a bonus point for you in here, and I'll tell you what that is after we've had some listens. Well, Fernando, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get your first listen. Right, that was your first listen.
All right, so we've definitely got a march here.
All right, so that's your genre. Yep.
Yeah, it is a march, and it's a 6/8 march, which is a little unusual, but that's just something of note. Okay, so we got the genre of march. Time period, well, I gotta say it sounds like a Sousa march, so I'm just gonna say like the 1800s, so you know, yeah. Late romantic kind of.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you would be correct there.
Okay. So.
And you're guessing Sousa as the composer as well.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Sousa as the composer. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so the movement here is kind of null and void. So that's kind of a bonus point for you.
Okay.
Because.
Yeah. There's not really a second movement to this one. Okay.
Yeah. No multi-movement marches here.
Yeah.
But so we do have still have the piece left to guess.
Right. Sousa is correct?
Yeah, Sousa okay. is correct. Do you want your second listen?
Yeah, let's get the second listen.
All right. That is your second listen.
All right, so this is the hard part because there are so many marches by Sousa that makes it very difficult. So the 6/8 ones, the first one that comes to mind is Washington Post. I think that one's in 6/8, but that's not Washington Post. Is it? No, it's not.
No,
that's
not. I was going to say that. It's not Washington Post.
Okay, good. I was like, that's definitely not. But it is in 6/8, right?
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Well, do you want your third listen?
Sure. Let's do it for fun.
That was your third listen.
I don't think you're going too wild on me here with something that's unrecognizable or something that's more obscure.
This is one of his more famous marches, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not out of the depths of his catalog, that's for sure.
Yeah. And it is, there are so many marches.
Yeah, there's so many. Well, what would be your guess?
All right, I gotta come up with something. I don't think I have played this one. The two that I'm between right now, hopefully this doesn't embarrass me right now, are Liberty Bell March and Esprit de Corps.
All right, well, what would be your final
guess? I don't know, man.
Out of the two.
Okay. Go with Liberty Bell March.
Oh, my gosh, Fernando, you got it. You got it. You pulled this one out once again. That was the Liberty Bell March by John Philip Sousa. And, wow, I knew you were going to be able to get 4 points, but I was like, okay, I don't know if he's going to be able to get that fifth point. But you narrowed it down, so that's good stuff, Fernando.
Yeah, I was very close to not getting that, but I kind of went with my gut there. I out of the ones that I like knew, I was like, I think this is the one, because I don't know it that well, like I don't know the tune that well, obviously,
right?
But I was like, this one's pretty common, I think this one is it. So yeah, I had to go back into the Rolodex a little bit.
Well, that puts you at 25 points thus far, and I'm trailing behind in with 18 points. Last week I got pretty close to you, but I think there's been two lifetime points that I've missed. That's my problem. And right. So you've gotten every single one 100% correct so far. I'm trailing behind, but hopefully I'll catch up pretty soon.
Yeah, I think you will. You'll get me on one of these.
Yeah. I thought I had you on this one.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Well, we hope you all had fun trying to guess that lick with us. Let's go ahead and move on to today's topic. Welcome to today's topic. Today we are discussing a few pieces from the repertoire of the Wind Band. We're going to play for you a program of three works, and the selection is based off of the selection of the American Academic Band System. And the repertoire of the Wind Band is really, in a large part, owed to these American school bands in middle schools and high schools throughout the nation. And each state in the U.S. typically has some variation of the Wind Band. Some call it the Music Performance Assessment. Some call it the Concert Performance Assessment, CPA or MPA, whatever it is. They have it for their high school or middle school bands. And while there's some variation in these, typically the programs follow some kind of structure where you have a warm-up selection that features a march or some kind of chorale, and then two contrasting pieces for a total of three works. So we decided to challenge each other to create programs of our own within these boundaries and share them with you. And this week, we'll have a program that we've put together, kind of a combination of two different programs that we came up with that we ended up combining. And then our next Wind Band episode, we'll have the rest of those works. But we both grew up attending and participating in these music performance assessments, so we thought it'd be fun to present you with some of these sample program ideas that they'll give you a taste of what the wind band genre is about if you're not familiar with it. Believe it or not, both of us are actually wind band guys. I don't feel like most people that listen to the show would actually know that.
Right, yeah, we do have a lot of orchestral music. We feature a lot of orchestral music, so it seems like we're more orchestral players, but we are primarily playing in wind band.
Right, yeah. I think the majority of our playing careers have been in the realm of the wind band, so it's definitely a genre that we're both really passionate about, and we're really familiar with the music of. not that you'd be able to guess that with all the orchestral music we play on and discuss on the show. But anyway, I say we go ahead and get into our first piece. Fernando, do you want to introduce us to this piece?
All right. So our warm-up selection, our march for today is very fitting with the Guess That Lick. it is also a march by John Philip Sousa, an American composer who lived from 1854 to 1932. And the selection is Nobles of the Mystic Shrine.
Right, yeah, and let's tell our audiences a little bit about this work before we get into it. It was published in 1923. This concert-oriented march celebrates Sousa's membership in the ancient Arabic order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine, now known as the Shriners or Shriners International. It's a Masonic fraternity that was established in 1870.
Right. And there's some really interesting instrumentation choices in this work. It features the jingling Johnny, or the Turkish crescent, which is a marching instrument with a pole hung with jingling bells. It's very prominently featured in this work, and a lot of school bands will have to make it on their own, because it's not really something you can easily find at your local guitar center or music store. So it prominently features that instrument, as well as the triangle and tambourine, unusual for most marches, for most percussion sections on the high school and middle school band level. The triangle and tambourine players aren't usually the ones that are getting the most love and attention there.
Wow, yeah. And it's crazy to me because this is within the last 9 years of his life, him writing this march. So it's definitely showing off the musical maturity at this point of Sousa at this point.
Right. And maybe he was also thinking about expanding his band and doing a little bit more.
Right, let's do more now.
Right.
We've done all this stuff. We'll talk a little bit more about Sousa's prolific career here in a little bit after we listen.
Right.
But he definitely did a lot.
Right. And so just one more instrumentation thing here. This work also has a part for the harp. So pretty unusual for wind band marches to have a harp.
Absolutely.
Some more about this work. He conducted the premiere with an enormous band of 6,200 Shriners in Griffith Stadium in Washington, D.C. And after premiering this work, Sousa kept really close ties with the Shriners, being a member, of course. In the last years of the Sousa band, almost half of the band consisted of Shriners.
Wow.
So, yeah, large, a very close connection there.
That's so cool. And I didn't really know the story behind this work. I've always really enjoyed it, but I'm glad that we learned that today. That's great. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go ahead and take a listen to some of John Philip Sousa's Nobles of the Mystic Shrine, written in 1923. Let's take a listen.
Was Sousa's Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. Hopefully you were able to catch the jingling Johnny, the triangle, and the tambourine parts, because that's what we were just talking about, and we just think that it's such a great inclusion to this piece. It really gives it that Turkish feel that he's going for, and it has a very different feeling than a lot of other marches. I think it has a really dramatic quality to it as well. What do you think, Alex?
It has it all. It really does. I am just in love with all of the auxiliary parts in here. They give it so much character. And then, like, the dogfight sections of this, it just, like, it has that nice heft. And then this performance by the Marine Band is just so stellar. A really, really great recording here, and we're glad to be able to feature it on the podcast.
Exactly. So a little bit about John Philip Sousa himself. He was a violinist, mostly, a violinist mostly, and that was really what he really enjoyed playing. He actually tested out a lot of different orchestral instruments, but the violin was the one that called his name. But you wouldn't expect that from his band compositions, his extensive list of band compositions.
Maybe he played harp.
Right.
That's why he put it in here.
He almost joined a circus band at the age of 13, which is another just fun little fact there. He might have been doing a lot of different things.
Right.
But he ended up with the Marine Band, and he actually was able to bring an incredible amount of prominence to the Marine Band in his lifetime.
Absolutely.
And after his success with the Marine Band, he led his own band, which people are very familiar with, the Sousa Band. They went on tours in the U.S. and Europe from 1892 to 1931.
And they performed more than 15,000 concerts in that time, which is crazy to me. I don't even know if either of us will perform a combined 15,000 concerts in our lifetime.
Yeah, that is an insane amount if you think about it.
That's concerts like every day, multiple concerts a day. Crazy. Right. Oh my gosh.
Right. And all over across the Western world.
It sounds like a dream, though. I mean, I'd love to do that. I'd love to play concerts every day.
It would be a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Sousa is known really well for his significant number of marches for the band repertoire, 136, in fact. So chances are, if you're going to program a march, you're probably going to program a Sousa march. However, Sousa actually did write other stuff, and we want to bring your attention to some of these other works that Sousa has written, because he is not just a one-note composer. He's written operettas, believe it or not. El Capitan is a really great example of that.
Right, you might be familiar with the march El Capitan, but it's also the title of an operetta by Sousa as well.
Yeah, so definitely worth checking out there. He wrote some vocal music, a couple other band works, Last Days of Pompeii, Chariot Races, Sheridan's Ride. All three of those are ones that we've started to familiarize ourselves with, and definitely are worth a listen for sure.
Right. So with that, do you think we should move on to the next selection on our program?
Absolutely. We're getting into another staple of the wind band repertoire here. This is Percy Grainger, an Australian composer who lived from 1882 to 1961. For those of you that have been sticking with the podcast, you should definitely be familiar with Percy Grainger. We've spoken about him on the show before. This is his Molly on the Shore. And this is a really popular wind band selection. And I actually wanted to read you a selection from Percy Grainger's program notes on the work. He wrote, "I strove to imbue the accompanying parts that make up the harmonic texture with a melodic character not too unlike that of the underlying real tune. Equally with melody, I prize discordant harmony because of the emotional and compassionate sway it exerts."
So now let's take a listen to Molly on the Shore by Percy Grainger.
Thank you.
That was Percy Grainger's Molly on the Shore. Another great work, another demanding work, I think, here. This is very technique heavy for the woodwind specifically, but I think for the entire band.
Absolutely. It requires so much maturity from the ensemble, and this performance really showcases some great maturity in musicianship. So really right. Great recording here.
And it's so demanding, too, with the outbursts and the Grainger-isms that we've talked about before on the show. Grainger's always writing these outbursts and little quirky statements that you wouldn't really find in other composers' works, in the same way, at least.
Especially in works that are so tuneful like this, because usually the two don't mix, but Grainger makes them mix, and as a result, it's quite a unique mixture and just a really fun listening experience. And that's characteristic of a lot of Grainger's works, Ligature Poesy as well, and many, many others that he's written for the wind band genre.
Right. A lot of great stuff from Percy Grainger in the wind band genre. Let's hear a little bit more about Percy Grainger as a person.
Right. So he's born in Melbourne, Australia, and then he moves to London and then the U.S. And while he's in the U.S., he's actually in the U.S. Army playing oboe and saxophone. The saxophone, funnily enough, is actually the instrument that he considers to be closest to the human voice. He had quite the reverence for the saxophone as an instrument. So interesting fact there. We've talked about this on the podcast before, but it bears repeating. His ranking system for composers, not too dissimilar from our ranking system that we do in our Top 100 Composers series. But he bases these on complexity and artistry, in quotes, of music, ranking himself as the 9th best composer of all time, ahead of Tchaikovsky and Mozart, but behind Delius and Bach. Bach is his number one composer on that list.
It's hard to compare in general. We've seen that from our lists already, but our lists are based more on just our personal taste rather than what we find to be the best music. But yeah, it would be incredibly difficult to place yourself onto a list of such big names and so many artists that you appreciate too. It's hard to look at your work objectively because you're attached to it emotionally in a way, and then you're also appreciating other people's work in a similar way. It's hard to look at their work objectively as well. So it's hard to put your name on that kind of list. And it's also hard just in general to compare artists in a way that makes it seem like this is the best artist.
I think that's an interesting discussion between like great music and effective music. That's a whole nother discussion.
Right.
With this ranking list that Grainger devised, you could tell that Grainger is not really a huge fan of the German style of romanticism that's happening at the time. Much of his musical identity actually came from his inspirations from folk music and Vaughan Williams, Elgar, and Grieg, and his relationship with Delius. He had a pretty good relationship with Delius there. So definitely a lot of great inspirations with Grainger, and he certainly left his mark on the wind band genre when not a lot of composers at the time were doing so. Him, Vaughan Williams, and Holst and Sousa are kind of some of the big names from that time. So there are others, but those are definitely some of the big names.
Right. Well, you mentioned Gustav Holst there, and funny enough, that is the composer of our next and final selection for today. Our final selection is Holst's First Suite and E-flat for a military band. Holst was an English composer from 1874 to 1934. So all kind of in the same time period here. That's kind of how it worked out because of public domain rights or copyright laws. But
right.
Regardless, we've got some information about the work here, about his first suite for a band. The work was completed in 1909. It was not premiered until 10 years later in 1919, though, at the Royal Military School of Music.
Yeah, really interesting there. He held on to this masterpiece for a little while, and then he's like, oh, I guess we can play it now.
Right.
but really interesting there. And then each movement is actually, so he he designed the beginning of each movement very meticulously. The first three notes of the first movement, the chaconne, are E flat, F, and C. And then the first three notes of the melody at the beginning of the second movement, the intermezzo, are E flat, F, and C. However, in the third movement, the march, Holst actually inverts the whole motif. The first note that's heard in the opening is E flat, but then it descends to a G, to a D, and then a G, the exact opposite of those first two movements. So I thought that that was an interesting analysis there. It might be a little bit a little bit wordy there, but I just found the theory behind that to be interesting.
It is really interesting, and I think that that has to be intentional. I mean, that,
oh, it totally yeah, was.
Which is really clever. It's a really fun thing there. So you've said already that there are three movements here. If you're unfamiliar with the work, there are three movements, and so that is also just of note there, so that you know how this work works.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're going to take a listen first to the chaconne, a segment from this movement. The chaconne is a traditional Baroque form of variations over a repeated bassline theme. And you'll hear right from the opening with this initial statement from the low brass. And that theme is carried on throughout the chaconne and also iterated upon throughout the work. So definitely keep your ears open for that. Let's listen to some of the chaconne.
Thank you.
So that was the first movement of Holst's first suite for band here. And this is the chaconne, a really English sound to me, a very English sound. And it has a striking resemblance to me, at least, to the music of Edward Elgar, who's another English composer. To me, it kind of has a sound similar to some of the variations, the Enigma variations that Elgar wrote. So Elgar coming a little bit before Holst, I have to wonder if maybe Holst wanted to kind of work off of that type of idea, right, or that work off of something that he heard in one of Elgar's concerts.
Absolutely. I think that there's that certain elegance that is can definitely be compared to Elgar, so I think that's a really apt comparison there. And Holst really just outdid himself with this opening, though, in terms of how he iterates on this theme. I think that there's so many great variations in here, and then there's so many great hidden statements of this theme. There'll be another melodic idea going on that's very prominent, but then it'll be the horns or somebody else playing that theme, and you're just like, oh, that's really, really clever there.
Right.
So he was great at weaving in those ideas throughout.
And I think that might be part of what makes it sound English, too, because Elgar does the same things, where he's very clever with his use of motifs throughout the Enigma variations, but also throughout his other works as well. He's very careful but clever with his restatements of themes and motifs. And now that I'm thinking about it, I think that a lot of English composers have done that. I think Vaughan Williams has a way of doing that as well, where it's not like completely overt. When he's restating things. It's not the same way, though. Holst and Elgar, I think, have a much closer connection in that way.
Right, yeah. Vaughan Williams is a different kind of sound. It's also my favorite kind of sound. That's some of my favorite wind band music. But Holst is no slouch when it comes to that British style, that's for sure. And his works for the wind band are definitely ones that have stood the test of time. Next, we're going to go ahead and listen to the second movement of Holst's first suite for a military band. This is the intermezzo, and that's usually used as an operatic term, a kind of intermission, if you will, between two dramatic movements of music. And in this case, that's perfectly that's a perfect description, because you have the chaconne and then the march after this, and the intermezzo bridges the gap. But we both think this is actually our favorite movement.
So. Yeah, it's definitely very exciting. It's not just a device to get from movement one to movement three. I think it's very important as its own movement, and it's very melodic, very fun. With all that being said, we've got to hear it, so let's take a listen. Thank you. That was the second movement from Holst's first suite in E-flat for military band. This was the Intermezzo, the second movement. Both of us find this to be a great exhibition of Holst's transitional writing, but also I find it to be amazing how he can take just two distinct themes, and again, he's just exhibiting how great he is at stating one theme, transitioning back to theme, the first theme, and then layering those two themes together, incorporating everything together into a very unexpected but cohesive idea.
Right, totally cohesive here. I totally agree. It's just so much of this great masterclass in transitional writing, not only, but these gorgeous melodies interspersed with these little triangle interruptions, and then the woodwind articulation, and then there's moments where the low brass has brings us in with like transitions and the low reeds, and man, it's so organically done and just so natural and so clever and fun.
Right, and it has a feeling of being almost improvisatorially, where right. It's like, oh, this is just what I'm thinking about. But I have a feeling that this was very thoroughly planned out because it just works so well together. I could see how it's like, oh, this would be fun, and let me just put this in. But I do have a feeling that he might have had to plan it out because it is more complex than it seems, I think.
More often than not, the second movement of a work is so overlooked in the grand scheme of music history, particularly in the realm of symphonies. And in this case, I think that the most thought probably went into this second movement because it's just so well done and so well thought out, so meticulous, like you said.
Right. So that's some great, great composing from Holst there. Let's go on to the third movement. And the third movement is a march, so we've got another march here to kind of wrap up everything for the listening today. So let's go ahead and take a listen to Holst's first suite in E-flat for military band. This is the third movement, the march. We'll be right back.
was the final movement of Gustav Holst's first suite for military band, The March. And what a British sounding work. We keep saying that, but it really does have such that elegant, such an elegant British sound that is just so characteristic of the music of the time. And I love these little quotes of the intermezzo and the chaconne that are interspersed throughout, especially about 20 seconds in, he already brings us back to that gorgeous theme, that gorgeous B theme from the intermezzo that is just so well done, but it works so well in the march.
Right. Well, when you write a good theme, you want everybody to know about it, I guess. But he does it well. He does it tastefully.
Yeah, and even just that opening, I think that that opening is so, it's so kind of cutesy a little bit, but it's, there's this certain level of intensity to it. That's why I think it's a good one to end our wind band program here for you today, because it has that kind of, that good band characteristic, I think, of a good ending to a concert. Because typically you, in other concert venues, you would open with a march and then your encore would be a march. So this is almost like our encore of this program.
Right, exactly. But this time we're ending with a march that is very distinctly British, like you said.
Yes.
Different from the Sousa marches and more traditional American marches from the same time period, because obviously they were different countries, or they still are different countries, and they have different ways of doing music, right? We've developed different ways of doing music, and so the British march is slightly different than the American march, normally taken a little bit slower. You're not going to find as many circus marches that kind of accelerando throughout or
right.
anything like that in the British style of marches. They're just a little bit different there.
And that's not to say that these British marches can't be raucous or anything. I mean, you hear in that opening, it does get a little bit raucous and
right.
Kind of cutesy there, like I said. What a great work by Gustav Holst. Let's learn a little bit more about Holst as a composer and a person, because I think that's important to give you guys some context of who Holst was. He studied at the Royal College of Music with Ray Vaughan Williams, which we've mentioned multiple times on this show, including a couple weeks ago now, our spotlight on Ray Vaughan Williams. Definitely check that out. The Planets are another work that's really highly beloved by Holst, but he's also got some really underrated ones that Fernando and I have talked about. Holst was a trombone player while he was studying at the Royal College of Music, and he also played in the Queen's Hall Orchestra under Richard Strauss. And he was also a piano player, but had to give that up in favor of the trombone because he had some nerve issues in his right hand.
Really interesting there. I think the most interesting thing is that he's a trombonist, right? And
right.
so, first of all, that's not common for a lot of composers to be trombonists and then be a composer almost full-time.
One
or
of the
full-time.
Few that I know that's a trombone player.
Right, and it's so evident in his music. The trombone lines in this work that we've highlighted today alone are great trombone lines. I think any trombonist, young or more experienced, would really love to play any of these lines or any of these movements alone from this this first suite.
Right, and with Holst additionally being a trombone player, his other big thing was that he had a pretty extensive education career, and he enjoyed teaching young people and passing on his knowledge, and that really shines through in this music in particular. That's why it's so popular with school bands, and that's why we chose to highlight it today, because it is great educational work in terms of style and musicality, and is great for young students, and also fun music for them to latch onto, but is very educational, and this is a work that we would strive to be able to program with our students if we were teaching a band.
Exactly. All of the works that we talked about today, all three, are very challenging works on their own. And so these aren't ones that we would walk into any band room and say, hey, let's pull this up. You know, it takes some time, and this is challenging music for any band. But yeah, definitely one that I would strive for, and I think we both would strive for is the Holst and the other works that we've mentioned today as well.
Exactly. You would need a really killer woodwind section in particular for these works. And also really, really sensitive percussion sections with the Sousa and the Holst as well. Then you have with the brass section in the Granger and the Holst requires a whole lot of great musicality to pull that off. So all around, just really, really difficult program, but one that is worthy of putting together because it's all such great music.
Right, and I think it's a diverse program as well, to at least to an extent. While the ethnicities aren't super diverse, we've got an American, American, Australian, and English, so all English-speaking countries.
Right.
But the music, I think, does have very specific nuances. There are very specific ways you play there are very specific ways you play Sousa. There are very right. specific ways you play Granger, and it's the same for Holst. Each composer has very distinct compositional methods and a style that you want to achieve in each piece. So I think that's really important as well, especially in the educational field. I think you would want to demonstrate the different styles. Funny enough, they're all from around the same time period.
Right.
But they do have distinct styles because they're distinct composers.
This is a program that you would probably see in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s being programmed because there wasn't a whole lot of diversity amongst band music. I mean, these are some of the staples now, and they were definitely staples then because that was what you would see on a lot of repertoire studies from the times, Osling studies. We'll have to get more into those in another wind band episode, but these works are some of the frequenters of those lists. So it's really interesting with the wind band genre because it's one of the most diverse, especially once you start to get into the 70s and the 80s. And now there is so much wind band music being written, and we can't play that newer stuff for you because we don't have the rights to it. It's not in the public domain, but hopefully someday we can get some of that on the show and show you how much wind band has progressed, because there's this great music and this is a very traditional program, but wind band is such a huge and diverse genre, and we're not trying to lock our listeners down to just this sect of music, but this is the music that we have available to us that we can play for you. So
right, great point there. I really enjoy the more modern wind band music as well as this this style of music and this older time period of wind band music, the kind of the beginnings of wind band music in a way. With all of that being said, I think we're about done for today. We really hope that you have gotten some more context and some more information about a genre you might be familiar with or might not be familiar with, the wind band or wind ensemble genre. And hopefully you can take a listen to the full works. Actually, I think we listened to all of
them. Yeah, we just about listened to all of them, minus the chaconne. So.
Right. So hopefully you can explore a few more pieces in the wind band genre. And if you're interested in learning more about the wind band genre, let us know through our social media apps or through email. All of that will be listed in the outro here.
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. And be sure to tune in next Monday for more of the Leading Tone Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at the Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram and the Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of the Leading Tone Podcast.